Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi, and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast from These Football Times. Javier Milei, the president of Argentina, has unleashed a reform regarding the ownership regulations of the country's football clubs, including some giants of the world game, potentially throwing open the doors for them to be acquired by foreign private enterprises or clubs enmeshed in the multi-club system. I'm Gary Thacker, and in this edition of the podcast, we will be looking at the potential implications for club football in Argentina, and perhaps even if the development may affect the national team. No conversation concerning politics and football in South America would be complete without the wit and wisdom of TFT's very own specialist on the subject, Dr. Pete Watson. Evening, Pete.
How you doing, Gary? You all right?
I'm good, thanks, matey. Among the many other rocks lobbed into the social pool of Argentina by Señor Milei, this one's causing more than a few ripples, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, it has been for probably, I don't know, as soon as Milei really came on the scene, so for about a year and a half, 2 years really, from about 2022, late 2022. So it's been one of the two big issues in Argentine football, along with the kind of Enzo Fernandez chant scandal that people have been getting hot under the collar about for various reasons. So it's very much a hot topic.
Indeed. Well, we're going to give it a good airing tonight. Joining Dr. Pete and myself, we also have Matthew Gibbs, who has plenty of strong feelings about club ownership and particularly the multi-club model. Thanks for joining us, Matthew. Looking forward to the chat.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to learning about some Argentinian football.
Yeah, me too, mate. It's always an education with Dr. Pete on board. Right, let's get started. Before I ask for Matthew's opening comments, I'm going to ask Pete to give us a brief outline of the previous model of club ownership in Argentina and the changes that Milei is seeking to implement, with particular reference to a change of their, at least theoretical, not-for-profit status, and also whether it challenges the existing social structure of power in football with regard to the AFA.
Okay, so the basic situation is that all of the Argentinian clubs are what are called asociaciones civiles sin fines de lucro, which is basically civil non-profit making associations. So what this new reform law is purporting to do is allow the football clubs to become sociedades anónimas deportivas, in a literal translation of anonymous sporting societies, which effectively means they're allowing private investment in. That's basically the long and short of it. Now, the law is not obligatory. What it does do is a couple of important things. So currently, the statutes of the Argentine Football Association, the AFA, mean that you have to be one of the kind of civil association clubs to be part of the league. So it's currently not in the statutes of the Football Federation to allow the SADs, as their initials, the private corporation. I quite like the SADs thing. I'm tempted to use it throughout, but yeah, they're not allowed to have these private corporations. Basically, we go back about how these clubs are founded. These clubs are all founded, firstly, really by mostly teenagers or young men. If we go back to some of the city podcasts we did about Buenos Aires and Avellaneda and Rosario, all of the clubs are largely founded for a sporting purpose. But what they also get is they acquire very social community significations as well. And that's really at the heart of one of the major issues about this problematic situation, is that the clubs are inherently part of their community and part of their barrio. They are formed by members. They are owned by the members. And it's not just a football club. All of the clubs that we're talking about will be running lots and lots of other activities as well. And again, just to give you a couple of examples, San Lorenzo, one of the big five, apart from being a football club, they also have esports, basketball, volleyball, handball, tennis, lawn hockey, roller hockey, artistic skating, swimming, martial arts, rhythmic gymnastics, boxing, ping pong, and fitness sessions. So these are things that they're running for all of their members. So if you can imagine basically a social club, you know, because again, historically, they're not just doing their sports, they're also doing community events. If you look back in the history, you'll find, you know, the tango and, you know, singing and dancing and these very big community events being an intrinsic part of the identity of the clubs. So that's really at the heart of it. These are things that generate Argentina sportsmen. again, some private schools in Argentina do sports, you know, mostly kind of things like rugby, hockey. You'll look to see probably, you know, private schools being behind them. But mostly, probably a lot of the Olympians that we're seeing in the Olympics at the moment are probably coming from these type of clubs. That's where they learn their sports. That's where they learn their values. That's where they become part of the community. So one of the major arguments or one of the major fears that most Argentinians have and most kind of, I suppose, traditionists, if you like, are saying, as soon as we take that community aspect away by allowing private investment in, and again, the fear is that private investment will just be investing money, it will just be for profit, that's quite a lot of these social activities will become less valued. They will become moved away or got rid of because they're not profit making. Now, obviously, you know, any kind of investment that will come in, this will be a major issue for the members, because what will have to happen for this to take place, and again, as Milei, the president, and the sports minister and the justice minister keep on saying, this is optional. It would have to be voted for by the members for this to happen. What also would have to happen, which is very important, is that the Argentine Football Federation would have to change its statutes by the 1st of November this year in order to allow these anonymous sporting corporations to become part of the league. This is something that AFA is very reluctant to do, the extent that in a recent vote, 45-0, voted in favour of keeping the statutes as it is. So that essentially is kind of background into the nature of the clubs as they stand and what would kind of matter legally. The other thing that I think is important to say is that there are some clubs that might be tacitly in favour of this. One of the clubs is Talleres, which is a club from Córdoba, not one of the biggest teams, but certainly a club with a huge amount of tradition. They have an owner who is a club president, who is more of an entrepreneur, who is known to have links with Mexican clubs and is known to favour this kind of process potentially coming into operation given his previous experiences. Juan Sebastian Verón is also notionally in favour of it, but more of having a German system where we have 51% of the ownership and members and 49% for private investment. It's also rumoured that quite a few other club leaders might also be in favour but don't want to say anything because it would be the quickest way of losing support for any future elections that might come up that keep them in power or not. So that's more or less the kind of situation, the clubs and what the law is, where things kind of stand and what.
It's fascinating. Coming to you, Matthew, I guess, you know, I mean, there's not a direct parallel with England, but you can see some links where, you know, years, many years ago, certainly in my youth, you know, the top football clubs were owned by the local butcher, baker and candlestick maker. And, you know, you look at it now, especially after the Premier League, there's sport enterprises from America and sovereign investment funds from, I mean, crazy amounts of money being pumped in. And the question you have to ask yourself is, you know, I don't know, would you think that change has helped English football, and might the change help Argentinian football? There's a million-dollar question for you to start off with, Matthew.
I'm laughing already. Nah, I mean, I personally really do not like the direction that football is going in, especially in Europe, especially in Britain. Very, very sanitized version of the game where everything is now aligned on a spreadsheet, right? I think the rise in the multi-club model of football is really ugly. It's very, I'm not sure, is disrespectful the right word? Disrespectful of a lot of smaller clubs' history. I know it's a weird thing to bring up maybe, but David Squires, who's the cartoonist for The Guardian, did a really interesting one of his cartoons weekly when it was announced that the Blueco who bought the shares in Chelsea bought Strasbourg in France. And it was this beautiful cartoon about a guy's life and how he'd grown up supporting Strasbourg, and he grew up, took his son down to the game. They both had shared memories watching some great players down there, very proud of that tradition, very much a club rooted in their community. And all of a sudden it turns into a product of Chelsea where they send their children to, it's used as a sandpit to send the kids that Todd Boehly has bought to, you know, to practice, to give them space to train so then they can bring them back to Chelsea. It's an ugly future of the game, I think, and it's something that is losing all passion, losing all meaning, and losing all soul. Everything it's becoming very soulless. The Wall Streetification of football, I think, is the route we're going down. I have plenty of speeches lined up for when we
good get man.
Into the multi-club ownership, but I think it's think it's ugly. And I think especially in countries like Argentina, it feels like a very delicate road to walk down, both from a political point of view and from the owners of the clubs. It feels like the internal democracy of Argentinian football is very important, especially to citizens of Argentina. It might not be the most prestigious league in the world, might not be on the same level as some of the European leagues, but everybody knows about the passion of the fans. Everybody has seen La Bombonera, like, you know, in full flow and seen them chanting, and everyone marvels at it. It's like everybody would love to go visit. And messing with that feels like a very precarious route to go down. And it seems like it's just going to blow up in people's faces, especially for the politicians involved, and especially for, you know, the owners of the clubs.
Before we get into what might happen, Pete, what Matthew was describing then about, you know, this guy, the David Squires cartoon, the guy who takes his son to Strasbourg and the link with the club, and is not terribly different to what you were saying about potentially losing the relationship to the Barrio, where the Argentinian clubs are sort of, I don't know the word I'm looking for, they're invested.
Yeah, invested, yeah. No, I think that's exactly it. And I think that there are certain fears about, I think a lot of it is kind of the worst case scenario fit. You know, I think obviously a lot of these arguments tend to be quite binary, and they tend to kind of state the worst case scenarios to get the fear on either side. You know, that's kind of standard way of debate nowadays. And that's the default starting positions. I think that some of the fears that have been raised by, you know, not just political opponents of Milei, because I think one of the things you have to bear in mind is that, you know, every single club, when Milei first proposed this, tweeted against this. So this became a rallying cry for Milei's opponents. It still is. You know, this is a way of politicians gaining support against Milei. The worst case scenario is, of course, that all of the assets are sold off. And again, you know, it's not just a football stadium. There are clubhouses. There are club facilities. There are, you know, swimming pools, basketball courts, gymnasium. So if investors want to sell these things off, they would be entirely in their rights to do so if they got financial control. And one of the things you've also got to bear in mind is the locations of a lot of these clubs, particularly the Buenos Aires or Avellaneda ones, who are in kind of prime estate, real estate locations in the center of Argentina. So again, we could have, you know, these situations where, you know, the slightly dodgy investors coming in looking to sell off places and then build a nice supermarket, blocks of flats. You know, that's been a fear that's been raised by certainly opposition politicians, you know, from Buenos Aires. So I think, you know, you are endangering a fabric. And I think that, you know, the members of the clubs in Argentina very much hold these things very dear. You know, the history is very important. Football fans are inherently conservative. And, you know, they're kind of pointing out, saying, this, our club de barrio, our barrio clubs, are the ones that are leading us to be world champions. Now, Milei will kind of come out and say, well, and in fact, he did. He put a tweet out saying, you know, if the AFA is opposed to the SADs, the anonymous sporting corporations, why does it allow the national first team to come from such societies? You know, could it be that results are important, the SADs are the best players, enough of poverty, socialism, and football? This is his kind of message. And he, you know, part of the thing that Matt was saying about, you know, the Argentinian league has prestige. Is it one of the biggest in the world? Well, he thinks not. That's part of the problem. You know, if Argentina, you know, one of the things they're selling is here, if we want to be the best team in the field, if we want to be able to compete with Europe, and actually more importantly, if we can want to compete with Brazil, because Brazil did bring a law of this in 2021, allowing the Brazilian clubs to become private or have private investment. And some clubs have gone down that route. Bahia, obviously not one of the bigger clubs, but Botafogo, Vasco da Gama, Red Bull Bragantino, for example. Again, maybe not the biggest clubs, but it is happening. And what we can also see in South American football at the moment is Brazilian clubs are dominating the competitions that matter. Since 2016, only one Argentinian club has won the Libertadores. It's been totally dominated by Brazil. So if the argument is started to be proposed that with foreign investment, we can start bringing back some of our better players, holding on to some of our younger players, attracting improvement in facilities and so on and so forth, to the extent where we can start, you know, beating these Brazilian teams to win the Libertadores, but also winning the Intercontinental Cup or whatever version of it, Club World Cup, which is a massive deal in South America. You know, it's a much bigger deal in South America than it is in Europe. Then that becomes a potent argument in favour of we need to compete, because River Plate and Boca Juniors, you know, see themselves as the biggest clubs in the world. That's what they will argue, you know. You know, I mean, Southampton do the same thing, but you know, this is the thing that they want. So if you can make that argument strong enough, and this is kind of Millet's argument, then this is a kind of a danger that people see all these kind of possibilities flashing in front of their eyes, and we'll probably forget the bad examples of dubious ownership that have been in the past. I think that, the strength of local commitment, we haven't talked about power structures yet within Argentina. We can talk about that in a bit if you like, but the Baras themselves are very, very anti this. You know, Independiente, one of the obviously the biggest teams of the Big Five, put posters up saying, if you sell off the club for your families. Yeah. So, you know, we have got very militant fan groups who are very, very entrenched within the way a club is run. And they've got their own interest there as well, which we can go on to discuss a bit later.
I actually wanted to ask about the Barra Brava because I wondered if you've listed some reasons for why Millet and others may want this to happen. Is part of that to take the sort of the power away from the Barra Brava? Is there too much local power in their hands? Or
this is a really, really big issue, and this is one of the issues that hasn't really come up much in the newspapers about the debate. So one of the things we have to acknowledge, or Argentinian clubs will have to acknowledge, is that club ownership and club management has not been good. A lot of the clubs have had financial problems. Racing, one of the Big Five, almost went bankrupt. There is actually an Argentine law to save football clubs because they are seen as being an intrinsic part of the community. It's actually called the Ley Racing, the Racing Law, after the fact that Racing was nearly went bankrupt. There are two really key things here, is that because it's a members club, whoever is in charge, whoever wins the elections, has a huge amount of community power. And that power can translate to political roles, I suppose, within the community and within the area. There is a long history of club presidents becoming significant presidents and significant politicians in the local area. Mauricio Macri, former president of Argentina, former president of Boca Juniors, and a supporter of Milei. So he is very much in favor of this. During his time in Boca, he was very much in favor of bringing in these SADs. So I think there is a lot of potential power within club football, huge amount of power. Now, as soon as you open up that into investment, you are, I suppose, challenging that power structure that already exists. What is also part of that power are a kind of clientelistic system of power relations and economic relations that kind of simmer down in lots of different ways. Now, that includes with the Barra Bravas. There's an Argentinian academic called Eugenio Paradiso, who's just written an academic book about financial corruption and power structures in Argentinian football. And it's been long established that these clubs have got links with the Barra Bravas and they've got some kind of ties with organised crime. So you have kind of the Barra Bravas swinging behind certain clients to always support them. You have things like ticket selling rackets going on. You have things like them paying for them to travel to certain places. So as soon as you have investors' money, you are damaging a very, or in some clubs anyway, potentially, quite a nuanced and quite a web-like structure of clientelistic power and economic relations. And the Baras are very much part of that, or have been very much part of that. So that's a very interesting scenario. And I think that's also a question that does jeopardize people who are maybe wanting to invest in that kind of case. You know, we have had situations where Baras have gone on a rampage within club offices against faulty management or against people not kind of fulfilling their sides of bargains. If investors are going to do that, they are also effectively taking on the Barra Bravas, and that may not always be good for business and makes for a slightly more contentious potential relationship or ways of managing a club. So I think they are a huge part of the existing problems of Argentinian football, corruption, economic mismanagement. I think that actually there have been a couple of surveys which I was looking at in terms of this issue. And one of the surveys says that 77.6 people have interviewed were in favour that AFA would allow members to decide if they want to adopt this model. So that's kind of a diplomatic open. So it's fine if they want to at least have the option. What they also say is that they think that there is potentially, or 66.4% of people said they thought this actually might lead to a more effective management of the clubs, because we do see this idea of leadership corruption, of links with potential crime, of bankruptcy for a lot of the clubs, of being in debt. That doesn't mean they're in favour of the SADs per se. That just means they want to have a choice or think that the management of clubs can often be very bad. However, more than half of people interviewed in a different survey were against the fact that SADs should exist, this law should exist. So you can just see the types of issues, that there is an acknowledgement of corruption, criminality, poor management. Maybe it's good that we should at least have the option, but equally a kind of a fear that a lot of the most important things within Argentinian football in terms of its culture, in terms of its social identity, can be destroyed. And I think you also have to remember is that we're talking about a country with a colonial heritage and one who's very angry about that heritage. You know, it came out very strongly in the France-Argentina racism scandal. You know, how dare a colonial power tell us what to do about racism, blah, 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 blah. So if you have another example of Argentina selling off its family silver, much like Carlos Menem did back in the 90s, a president who I always like reminding Argentinians that Maradona, you know, heartily supported, you know, the great left-winger Maradona who supported Menem, you know, you're selling off another part of the family heirlooms. You know, one of these things that is very much at the heart of constructs of Argentine national identity, of community identity, of sporting pride in a country that, you know, maybe doesn't have all those reasons for pride. So, yeah, I hope that's a slightly long-winded answer that's gone into various different directions.
That's a good point. It's interesting, you know, I mean, obviously what we're talking about now, or what the Argentinian fans' reaction is now, is very much, it's in the abstract. Now, if somebody comes and says, we want to invest in Boca, we want to put £100 million into Boca, we're going to bring back some of the great players, you wonder whether the sort of the sway of public opinion might sort of differ slightly. I just want to sort of, let's assume for a second we have that sort of thing potentially happening. I mean, so if this does go through, and, you know, there's an investment open, are Argentinian clubs going to be a target for massive rich corporations? Could they see they're making money there? I guess, you know, might we see River Plate Google or Tesla Boca Juniors or Microsoft no longer Independiente? What do you think, Matthew?
I think one of the things about football, and one of the things that makes it so susceptible to these sort of financial deals, I can't think of a better way to put it than the search for authenticity. You know, the capitalizing on cultural cultural currency, and if you are a hedge fund or you know, some other sort of corporation that has billions and billions of pounds, and they can go around and buy a football club, the cultural currency you can get from saying we're going to buy one of the biggest clubs in Argentina, it's an authentic, you know, we're investing in that authentic experience. I think that more so than a lot of other countries around the world will make it so ripe for that sort of investment. And it's one of those things that it sounds great from the start, but in the longer term, I have yet to, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but this multi-club model, I don't think there is a single positive example of that around the world. Pete already mentioned something that's happening in Brazil, in Vasco da Gama, bought out by 7-7 Partners, who own, is it 10 or 11 clubs around the world? And every single one of them is an absolute disaster, proper fiasco. All of the clubs, all of the fan bases are in open revolt. There are certain clubs, it's Standard Liège in Belgium, on the brink of bankruptcy. Hertha Berlin, the fans are in open revolt, and I think forced them out of the club. It's the ultimate search for that authentic experience and being seen to be doing the cool thing, the trendy thing, that is a very short-term approach to this sort of thing. And I just don't think I've seen an example of it working out in the long term.
Yeah, interesting. Pete, I mean, you mentioned the potential if big money comes in and they sell off other non-football interests, well, certainly some of the non-football interests and infrastructure to make profits. Would many football fans in Argentina consider that price worth paying if they were going to get a massive amount of success for the club?
I mean, that's the big question, isn't it? You know, I think every football fan wants success. I just wonder if that kind of, this might be a slightly difficult price to pay for everything else that they lose. You know, I can see that a lot of fans could be persuaded by, you know, a German kind of Bayern Munich type model. You know, I can see that working. That's the kind of thing that the Verón has been advocating for. And it's worth saying that there are several kind of respected historic figures of Argentine football who are kind of either wholly positive or potentially cautiously positive about this option. You know, both have got interests already. You know, Kun Agüero, Sergio Agüero, has said that it would be a good thing. You know, again, he's got obviously his ties with Man City. You would imagine that he's potentially angling into be some kind of role you know, in a City Group type situation potentially. Javier Zanetti has also said that it could be an option for other clubs that maybe have financial problems. I think it would be very unlikely, though, that the biggest clubs would, you know, the big five that would be tempted to this. So a couple of them have already made very strong statements. River Plate, well, all the big five, Boca, San Lorenzo, Independiente, Racing, have all said they're in a good financial situation, would never consider it. It's part of their identity. It's part of their fabric. But then if you do have, you know, owners that will, or new investors that will promise to keep this identity, be respectful for this identity, make a whole pledge of never losing that identity, you know, and again, we know how easy it is for people to be swayed by a good publicity campaign. People are fooled by positive needs and by emotions. Now, the emotion historically is against this. But, you know, if you're not winning and if you're suddenly thinking, why couldn't we be the biggest club with this investment? Why couldn't we do this? Then that can sway people. I personally don't see the biggest clubs yet being part of this. I don't think their pride would allow them to be subservient, because that's how it would be seen. You know, they're not going to be equal partners necessarily. So I don't see themselves being prepared to be subservient to a Chelsea or a Man City. I think that would be intolerable for the very biggest clubs. However, if you look at some of the smaller clubs or the lesser teams who have got a long-standing tradition, maybe they might be tempted. If there is the guarantees that the social features are going to be retained. But I just wonder how many fans would be prepared to give up all of their say, all of their control, and lose any type of ownership that they have in their club, because it is their club. You know, it is not the president's club. And this is always the biggest thing.
Yeah, right. I mean, I'll come back to the multi-club model later, but I just want to say about, let's imagine, there was talk a while ago when Real Madrid had the Bernabeu was rebuilt, and we talk about Microsoft having naming rights. They call it Microsoft Surface, which obviously the name of their laptop, which is quite neat, but it never happened. But I just wonder if one of the big five there say, let's just say for argument's sake, Boca took the brass of Microsoft, and suddenly the other five, the other four of the major five clubs were going to be left behind. They were going to be, Boca were going to sweep up all the trophies and perhaps get their Libertadores back into Argentina. You wonder the pressure would be then on the other clubs to, you know, once once one brick in the wall comes out, it's difficult to see not others following quickly, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an arms race. I mean, football is an economic arms race. And, you know, and the conditions are there for the temptation to be there. I mean, Millet said himself, he's a Boca Juniors fan, perhaps unsurprisingly. You know, but he said, you know, if you give me the choice to, rather than, you know, be beaten by Chelsea, Man City, Liverpool, Real Madrid, whoever it is in the Intercontinental Cup, to beat them because we've got all our players, and I'll take it. I'll take that straight away. So I think that's part of the issue, is that there will be an arms race there, and Brazil's current club, you know, domination on a continental level, and also that sense of the European leagues being the place where you have to go because you can't compete financially or in footballing terms, you know, with the very best now. That will rub against pride. You know, it clearly does. You know, Argentinians will always hate to be told that their clubs are inferior. You know, they'll loathe that. So you know, that is the emotional kind of prodding point to tempt them into these things, no matter what the various kind of club presidents say. Because again, it is a power game. You know, what we also have here is two things. Is that I imagine that if current presidents or potentially rival presidents who see their, you know, a rival doing a bad job, see the potential to make a strong case for investment, guarantee success, it is going to be part of that election campaign. And also, therefore, it'll be part of any kind of president's idea of staying in power as well, given all the benefits that he can accrue from this. And I do say he deliberately because football is a very masculine world, but given the impact for political ideas, business ideas, economic ideas, this is, you know, an opportunity that you're not going to lose. And I think it's also worth remembering that the head of the Argentinian Football Federation, Chiqui Tapia, a man who, by the way, you know, spoken against corruption, but a man who had swept moth off his brow by a lackey in the recent Copa America, have a look for that video footage for anyone interested. You know, he's sitting there and having a bloke actually mop his head for sweat. You know, he also does not want to lose power. You know, this is a very prestigious, a very powerful role that gives a lot of influence within the game and potentially within the world game. Look at where Julio Grondona got to, look at where Mauricio Macri got to. So if these chances, not for club competition, but also personal enrichment and personal power are jeopardized or offer more potential, then we will see campaigns starting. You know, I don't think there's any doubt in that.
Come to you, Matthew. I guess, you know, the time isn't right, but let's say 10 years ago, because it happens quite a lot over in Spain where presidents sort of canvass to get elected and they'll say, elect me and I'll bring X player or X manager on board. And I suppose potentially is to say, you know, we'll bring, you know, X amount of millions on board to win trophies. So, you know, if somebody could say, I say 10 years ago, elect me and the money of this organisation I'm in talks with will allow us to bring Leo Messi, for argument's sake. I mean, I'm stretching the sort of metaphor a little bit here, but to bring something like that, it's a compelling election pitch, isn't it?
I mean, I suppose it is. I don't know. Maybe I always take a bit more of a cynical approach to these sort of things, but I think it's very difficult to, I don't know the right way to put it, it's very difficult to believe these sort of things when they're said in these sort of elections. I think you have to be, full belief in that these sort of politicians are going to come through with their promises, which I don't tend to believe, maybe. But I guess it does make for a compelling pitch, and there's always the devil's advocate argument that that sort of investment that comes in, it means there's going to be investment in youth facilities, in infrastructure, in all sorts of ways to gain the edge over your competition. I think with Argentina, it's just very different to what we have here in Britain and in Europe, where, as Pete says, if they offer more community value than I think any club in Britain does for their club. I mean, in Britain, there is so much, there's campaigns, there's projects, you know, battling racism, all this sort of socioeconomic stuff that is important, but there aren't clubs in Britain that offer a handball team or a basketball team or offer, you know, education to the community or offer the opportunity to go swimming in a swimming pool, that sort of thing. The closest you're going to get, I think, is maybe Barcelona, but I mean, I have my own issues with how Barcelona do that thing. I think that's a sort of a fake marketing of their own sort of thing, the Mesquite club. It doesn't really exist anymore. And if these institutions that offer that sort of community value and it's at risk, much in the same way that in this country, if libraries get closed down and we argue against that, then I think it's a very difficult thing. It's very much be careful what you agree to, and be careful what you wish for. The grass isn't always greener.
Pete, before we get on to the multi-club model, there's a sort of middle ground, and, you know, clubs like Man United, Liverpool, Chelsea, they're owned by these sporting enterprise. They we've got Chelsea, they do, but the other clubs, they own more different clubs in different sports. Like, I think the Fenway Group own Boston Red Sox, and the Man United Glazers own Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So I guess, is that like almost less bad? Because there's no sort of other club, but they are obviously expert at club promotion, he says, trying to find the right words and falling over his mouth as he does.
I think this is part of the problem, isn't it, about associations. I think one thing that makes it in some ways tolerable is that there might be an idea of greater expertise at a management level. You know, I think that's a thing that is also critical. So I think if you can point to a solid economic structure, a solid management level that brings with it a platform of stability for the club, then there is some sense of acceptance of it. However, you know, I just wonder, you know, again, you know, the national question, you know, does an Argentinian club want to be owned by, you know, by Arabs, by Qataris, by Saudi Arabians, by Emiratis? You know, do they want to be owned by Americans? You know, I mean, just think, I mean, some of the modules I teach, you know, the whole of the 50s and 60s cinema was railing against neocolonialism by the America. Yeah, I mean, that's an argument that doesn't go away in South America. This is potentially another example of this. So there is a kind of pride at stake there as well, which because, again, you know, the members are not the ones that are going to see the money. This is also the thing. This is maybe the club doing well, but what they'll also see is the people who are kind of waiting there, you know, the kind of the businessmen, the investors, you know, and a lot of them will be friends of Milei. This is obviously the role of Macri, you know, there seem to be, you know, these kind of people are waiting to profit. And again, there is a lot of, you know, social argument against this type of poverty, you know, against this people getting rich and we don't ever change. So you're creating a very volatile situation, even with, you know, I suppose very, very rich owners with established business plans. And that's part of the problem, you know, do you want to be just part of the portfolio? You know, does River Plate, San Lorenzo, even Huracan, Talleres, San, you know, Temperley, whoever, Lanús, do they want to be part of a portfolio of clubs, or do they want to be Lanús, historic club of our barrio and our community? So I think that those symbolic identity meaning factors, you know, the pride, the you know, it's a difficult thing to convince quite a volatile potential electorate to go against.
I'll take your point. I was going to sort of raise the issue of these overrich sovereign wealth funds, and you know, particularly Newcastle, perhaps they could take over.
I think there's a point. So there's an interesting point as well, actually. You know, that one of the other things that is a genuine concern is about the overseeing of this. You know, what is not part of the bill is how will these clubs be overseen? What kind of restrictions and checking points are there? They're not there. You know, they're not in this bill. I mean, maybe some might say, well, if the government, for example, introduced the idea as part of the sports law that they have to invest X percent of, you know, of income or whatever it is on the other sports or club facilities, you know, but the government is not going to do that. So we have worries of money laundering. You know, we have worries of corruption. We have worries of, you know, checking the source and validity of the funds as well. You know, Argentina, you know, potentially doesn't have the mechanisms in place currently to be able to oversee that kind of financial, you know, watchdoggery, if you like. So I think that's a really important issue about, you know, how regulated will any of this actually be?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, if to bet Milei is sort of a hobby horse, is deregulation, and you know, is it going to be deregulated regulation? You can't imagine he's going to be, you know, too enthused by that. And I guess, you know, if this organisation X wants to put, you know, lots of money into this thing, they're going to want control, aren't they? Rather than, you know, it's just the way. And if they take the money somewhere else, just before we move on, I just want to just mention one thing, Pete. I know we spoke about this on previous South America Files conversations. There, Argentina is probably the most Eurocentric of the South American countries when it looks to Europe. And obviously, I mean, I think you mentioned earlier that Milei had mentioned about so many Argentine players are playing in European leagues where this deregulation is broadly in place.
Yeah, no, it is, without doubt. I mean, I find it ironic because they're so desperate to be seen as European historically. They kind of point to themselves as being, I suppose, Italian, Spanish migrants rather than African migrants. You know, that's a controversial comment. But, you know, that's kind of the way they see themselves. It's ironic that they are looking, however, to be owned by, or potentially owned by them. You know, that I think is an interesting kind of, you know, issue. I don't think they would want that. So I think that when Milei is, I mean, again, Milei will only talk about the good examples of this. You know, he doesn't mention, as Matt said, he doesn't mention the 777 group, you know, model. He doesn't mention the, you know, previous issues of ownership throughout the world of clubs struggling, you know, the Troyes situation this season, you know, the other ones that have been mentioned. So, you know, and again, it was quite ironic that the justice minister, when he was talking about, you know, again, part of the Milei cabinet was talking about how this was a good option and how, you know, Barcelona and Real Madrid were successful. He's like, well, they're not SADs, you know, that's not their model. And this is a man who was formerly, he was a legal advisor to the Racing board, who drew up their constitution to say that the club could not be owned by an anonymous sporting corporation. That was part of their constitution. He was part of that, you know, consultant's body, as he said, I was only a consultant. You know? Yeah. So we have this, you know, have that interesting idea of wanting to be like Europe, wanting to be successful, but they want to challenge Europe. You know, they want recognition from Europe. They don't want to be seen as, oh, the Argentine league got some big clubs, but you know, they're just crazy. You know, they want to be good.
It's interesting, I guess. You know, when, you know, with the it's almost reverse colonialism we're talking about, I guess, to some extent. Matthew, before we move on to the multi-club system, which I know you're going to have plenty of opinions on, given that the sort of investment possibilities we've spoken about here, and perhaps I'm going to chuck in the Sovereign Wealth Fund, where perhaps Newcastle United could take over, you know, Newell's, become Newcastle United's old boys. But is there any sort of, I know it's difficult to hypothesise, but in such circumstances, might this investment be beneficial to Argentine club football, do you think?
It's the sort of devil's advocate argument where you can, I think we mentioned it before, but there will be more investment, there'll be more money available to invest in youth football, in hypothetically grassroots football, in the infrastructure of a football club, in what they can do with the stadium, in what they can do elsewhere. I guess just with that sort of thing, it's always difficult because what happens next? Prices will go up for fan membership. Prices will go up to access to different community assets that they have on offer. And I mean, I guess as Pete mentioned before, there's the added bonus to, I guess, the politics that maybe the bit of power is taken away from the Bada Bravas, where I can imagine that that's something that they want. It's tricky, and they need to make sure that, I mean, it's different to in Europe where, you know, Americans can invest in English sport and the cultural differences are not that great. Like they're quite similar in many ways, but you go to a place like Argentina where there is, the ways things are done will be very different. The cultural importance put on football is manifests itself in a different way. You need to make sure that if you are a corporation investing in Argentinian football, you need to make sure that you're doing it in a way that respects what's come before, respects what's there now, and is done in a way that everybody's happy with, which it sounds like a very tricky road to walk down. Not one I would want to walk down. I wouldn't want to get involved in that.
the possibilities we spoke about already are sort of fairly new ones, but we're going to move on now to something. I know, Matthew, this is sort of close to your heart. Well, your opinions are pretty strong on this, but might Argentinian experience become another tentacle of the multi-club octopuses that running forwards across the football world? I mean, probably the best known example of multi-club ownership is the City Football Group, largely owned by the Abu Dhabi United Group. They first acquired Man City in 2008, but have significantly expanded their empire since, with investments in other 12 clubs all around the world, including New York City, Melbourne City, Yokohama, Marinos, Montevideo City, Torquay, which we've discussed in the past, Pete, Girona, Troyes, which you just mentioned, Mumbai City, and Palermo in Italy, amongst others. And the Pozzo family, who've got interest in Watford and Udinese, Jerry Cardinelli, the Redbird capital, AC Milan and Toulouse, Nasser Al-Khalifa, who was the Qatar sport investment, PSG and Braga, the Red Bull Group, obviously, famously Leipzig and Salzburg. I think you mentioned the one, Bragana, Pete, earlier. And they've also got, involved in Leeds United recently. Obviously, there's the Clear Lake Capital with Chelsea and Strasbourg. And I think they were interested in buying a club in Portugal. I think they were talking to a sporting club at some stage. It's a massive thing. But largely not exclusive. The club model often sees the owned clubs, the lesser clubs, the clubs that have been acquired afterwards, as feeder, supplying playing time to developing players, I think you mentioned earlier, Matt. It's therefore more likely that, as with Montevideo City Torque, the rich club would look for lower-rated Argentine clubs that could be purchased relatively cheaply and perhaps manipulated to serve the interests of the owning club rather than trying to do that with Boca, River, San Lorenzo, etc. Pete?
Yeah, I think that's the risk. You know, I think that the target points are not Boca, River. They would be very lucrative. They'd be very exciting. That's where a lot of the profits would be in terms of potentially making a profit. And I think something we haven't really talked about is the potential to make that profit. You know, this is a relatively untapped market in terms of investment potential. You have quite low wages. You have, I suppose, a strong footballing culture. You have a huge talent pool that you can already make the best of these talent scouting systems. I can't remember where Argentina were. I think Argentina have the third most players abroad currently, somewhere in the world. So I think that's a really big issue. So I think you are looking at that potential of what can be got out of it. And I think a lot of that can be got from the smaller teams who may have a certain degree more precarity. You know, we're maybe thinking about clubs like Estudiantes La Plata, for example. Verona said he might be very interested in it. Defensa y Justicia, a club that's had some decent runs in some of the continental competitions, Lanús maybe. You know, I guess it's those type of clubs that could be vulnerable to that kind of thing. And I think that, you know, that kind of feeder club or that kind of talent model, in lots of ways, it isn't really very different from what happens at the moment anyway, you know, where, a player just has to be fairly good and quickly an agent will whisk him off to the USA, if he's unlucky, to Portugal, to Belgium, to England, if he's really good. You know, we're looking at Claudio Echeverri. We talked about that talent drain. It's not really very different to what's happening already in lots of ways. It just kind of formalizes an agreement to ensure that certain players are going in the directions that certain clubs want. And, you know, and again, it's interesting. I was looking up stats about this. You know, there is something like, and this is March 2023, so things have changed in a year and a half. There are apparently 9,000 players in the world under contract at clubs and MCOs and multi-club organisations at the moment. There are something like 56 different countries around the world that are part of MCO groups. You know, last year, in 2022, 35 clubs in 21 countries that were bought up. That was increased from 30 the previous year. This is a trend. You know, if we're talking about one of the biggest countries for football in the world, you know, Copa America champions, you know, World Cup champions, and the historic clubs in the world. This is where the game is. This is where you're going to put your chips in because you have guaranteed traditions, lots of players, lots of potential, you know, and it's part of this globalizing chain of talent extraction already. So is it really changing anything more than formalizing it? You know, that's the problem. So I can completely see Chelsea, the City Group, Red Bull going in and trying to find their club that becomes part of the portfolio. You know, I'm sure they'll do that. I mean, this is part of the Millais argument. He's saying it's very easy business. It's like it's very Trumpian logic and Trumpian. This is an easy deal. It's a great deal for everyone. 300 million, billion pounds or dollars will come in immediately. You know, that's the kind of, you know, it's just we have this, they're waiting for us to come and give us their money and suddenly everything will be wonderfully better. You know, this is the Millais kind of logic.
You didn't say that, you know, everybody's telling me it's the best deal ever and I've made the best deal ever in the world and I'm the best ever. Yeah, okay. I'll come to you, Matthew, now. I mean, it's interesting, you know, what Pete says there. I mean, we did a pod with Pete a few weeks ago. We were talking about the talent drain getting even younger and younger, you know, 15, 16-year-old kids being snapped up. And I guess if clubs own a feeder club in Argentina, it'd be easy to place them there and see how they develop. But what we're talking about now with these clubs that are owned by the major club is not development. We're talking basically exploitation, aren't we?
It's gross. I think it's really gross. I think the direction that football's going in is horrible, turning certain clubs into nodes just to pass players along. So you've got, you know, how many clubs in... I think I did actually write this down. I'm going to go on my notes. In France, 9 of the clubs in Ligue 1 are part of multi-club models, and in Belgium, it's 8 of them. Belgium especially feels incredibly gross in that, you know, you've got teams like Brighton that use their feeder club in Belgium, which is Saint-Gilloise, a fascinating club. We could do an entire podcast series about Saint-Gilloise, fascinating club with a rich history, and now they are being used as a club where Brighton send players so they get work permits, which they can then play in England in the future. You have clubs like Vitesse in the Netherlands, who, the whole issues with that multi-club model where supposedly Abramovich was secretly funding them for years, and then when that money disappeared from Abramovich, they're in trouble and they don't know how they're going to fund the club because it's not a sustainable model of how to run an organization if you're relying on essentially a sugar daddy. They were deducted 18 points. They've been relegated from the Eredivisie. They might even be relegated even further down. There's a chance they might not exist anymore. A bit like Bordeaux in France, who, you know, had all these agreements with various clubs, including Fenway Sports Group. When the rug gets pulled out from under them, what do you do? They cease to exist. I think the multi-club model is one of the biggest nonsenses, the most dangerous routes in modern football. It's turning clubs and organisations and institutions from something that is culturally relevant into a line on a spreadsheet. You know, these clubs and these towns that have long histories of being involved in amazing sporting occasions, the incredible players that have come through, the entire history gets kind of devalued overnight, where now it's, I think... France is a perfect example of it. We've listed a few already, but look at what Bournemouth did to Lorient a few years ago. Took them over, stole away two or three of their best players, kept one of them. I think Dango Ouattara played a few games for Bournemouth, but Romain Favre, they sent back out on loan to, I want to say Bordeaux, actually. And now Lorient are relegated. There's Troyes, owned by the City Group, who suffered two successive relegations. That record transfer is Savio, has never kicked a ball for the club. Their other record signing, second one, is Metinho, who was also never kicked a ball for the club. Instead, Savio sent on loan to Girona, where he flourishes, and Troyes get relegated twice, and the fans are an open revolt. There's so many. I mean, Pete listed them already. There's 180 clubs around the world that are involved in these models, and the majority of them exist to serve other clubs. It's the marginalisation of football. It is the entrenchment of already existing inequalities, a lack of respect to local institutions and local cultures, and ensures all clubs are in the service of money. It makes football far, far less interesting than it should be. And I like what Cesare Manetti said about it before he passed away. He said, football is a cultural matter and belongs to the members and the neighbourhood in which they grew up. If you want to do business, open a DIY store.
But what do you really think, Matt?
I got more written down here. I could go on for ages. It winds me up something silly. Yeah. I think it's a...
Just with chucking your bench about Savio there, he's actually gone to Man City.
Yeah. Now,
Man City have signed him. Because, Girona have been an absolute revelation this season in Spain. They've got a young card called Michel who comes from Vallecano near Madrid. And they've been an absolute revelation. They've got two or three decent players, and they've sold Brovjic to Atletico, I think.
He's gone to Roma? I think he's gone to Roma.
Yes, at Lukaku, yeah. And Savio, I just interesting to see where the money went that City have to sign him. I mean, did the City actually just send it to Troy and have it back? Or did they just, I tell you what, guys, I'm just sticking in my back pocket. It's trouble.
The most perfect example of how gross all this is Fabrizio Romano, famous football transfer journalist who I have my own issues with, but that's for another podcast. Now, if you look at when he tweets and when he announces a signing, he doesn't say someone has signed for Manchester City. He says this player has signed for City Group. Sport is romantic. Like, you can't not be romantic about sport. It's that famous line from Moneyball, right? How can you not be romantic about sport? And this de-romanticizes, sanitizes everything. It's the Wall Streetification of football, and it's so not interesting. Transfers are not interesting anyway, but it's just it makes a mockery of the sport, and it devalues things that have come before and devalues what's going to come after. And there's going to be the bubble's going to burst at some point. I'm not sure what happens when the bubble bursts. I mean, I guess it's what's happening in France, where how many of the big clubs in France are now in the second division, the third division, and you don't know when they're coming back. Yeah, I think it's super depressing.
As you say, Pete, I think Matthew's been on the fence here about the value of multi-club things. But it's worth me asking the question, is the multi-club model morally fair and equitable, or just another manifestation of capitalist exploitation?
I mean, it's completely capitalist organisation, isn't it? I think Matt said it extremely well. You know, we're basically having, you know, it's almost like supermarkets. You know, we've got a big supermarket somewhere, and then we've got a little slightly, you know, we've got like a little Asda Metro sitting in Buenos Aires where we can get the same kind of idea of being part of a group. I think what's an interesting part of this is the stream of travel as well. You know, I think that, you know, if for example, Argentinians suddenly think that the great wonder kids of, you know, African or European football who are waiting to make it at Chelsea or at Man City or wherever it might be are suddenly going to be ferried across to Buenos Aires or to Rosario to go and play for Newell's Old Boys or to play for Lanús. I mean, I doubt it. I mean, I can't imagine that will happen because it hasn't happened. It's not part of the global flows yet. You know, I mean, maybe it will. I think it's one of those interesting things, if you look, is that, you know, South America is not a destination for European and African players. There have been, you know, occasional instances of it. So I think you'd have to be looking at significant change for a lot of these players to suddenly go across the world and go to South America instead. You know, wages are not as good as Europe. You know, that might change. So a lot of things have to shift in terms of global flows, and again, these are capitalist flows, entirely capitalist flows, and it's a capitalist instinct, and it's money making. And as Matt said, the profit will not go back to the clubs necessarily. The money is maybe it's going in certain things, but where is it going out? So I think you have to be very careful. If you suddenly think that your club is going to be suddenly bolstered in all kinds of ways through economic, through players, through infrastructure things, because as soon as the corporation or the investors overstretch themselves, as 777 seem to be doing, then suddenly the whole rug is pulled away from you, and there's very little left. Who's going to suddenly come in and pay off all those debts? Because then you're not a lucrative business model. You are a failed club that has to have a lot more investment put into it to save it. And that does not make you an attractive proposition. So that's where the risks are.
Yeah. I've got three final questions, but before we start those questions, I want to give Matt a final chance to have a pitch in on this multi-club, because I know he's been saving this up for a while.
I think Pete says it is something I thought about, a sort of analogy I thought about before. And stay with me here, but bakeries, right? So I'm from Birmingham. Lived most of my life in Birmingham. When I was a kid, I'm not that old. I'm 31. When I was younger, there were bakeries all over Birmingham. Now there aren't any. There are no bakeries anywhere. If you want to go buy bread, you want to go buy stuff, you have to go to your local Tesco, your local Morrison's, your local store, and it is the bakery at Morrison's, the bakery at Tesco. That is essentially what is happening to a lot of clubs around the world, where they're no longer their own, locally sourced, locally crafted, beautiful cultural asset that is something that everybody attends on a Saturday and everybody loves. It's a part of a conglomerate. It's part of the capitalist system in that de-romanticizes the entire sport, de-romanticizes everything that's come before and everything that will come again. And it's a dangerous road to go down. And I think I mentioned in my rant, previous rant, but there will come a time when the bubble bursts. And I mean, I feel like there are certain parts of this that are bursting already. Like we mentioned 7-7 Partners, but there's not a single one of the enterprises around the world that is working. Everything is going disastrously wrong. Savio going to Manchester City. Citigroup have been buying, I want to say for about 10 years, they've been buying teams around the world. This is the first time that one of the players has gone from that Citigroup and gone to Manchester City and has a realistic chance of being part of the first team. I can't think of another example of that actually working. And if, the whole point of that venture is to make money and to streamline this process of signing good players and forward and getting them forward to the first team. If it takes 10 years for the first player to make that route, that's not a very positive return on your investment. I think it's a very gross thing. I just feel like the bubble's going to burst at some point, and there'll be some major changes to football coming in the future, I think.
You have to forgive me, Matthew, but I thought when you're going to say about the bakers and the bread in Birmingham, you're going to say it's all about the dough.
Should have been.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, so I'll start with you, Matthew, because you were just sort of talking. So long as their club is winning games, do fans really care who owns the club, or even if it's owned by another club?
I think fundamentally, yes. But I think it's one of those ones where you get certain sections of the fan base that do and don't. So, I mean, you look at Newcastle, for example, being taken over by Saudi Arabia. Actually, not even using Newcastle. I'm going to use my own example. I'm a Birmingham City fan, and we're not multi-club model yet, but we have just been taken over by an American hedge fund. Pretty gross. It's not great. There's nothing romantic about it, really. And they've come in and they've made a lot of changes, for the most part positive. But we should not lose sight of the reason why they're here. They are a hedge fund that specializes in taking over struggling assets, turning them around and flipping them for profit. That's exactly what they're doing here. There's nothing, as much as our chairman might get very excited and, run around the ground clapping and being clapped and all that sort of stuff. And everybody, there's people dressing up as him with the ball caps and everything. It's all very, very fun. But we shouldn't lose sight of why they're doing this. It's just they're taking us over to flipping the future for money, or to make money from us along the way, much like the Glazers at Manchester United, all that sort of stuff. I think in the short term, fans might not care, but in the long term, they will. Yeah, there's always a blowback to these sort of things. These things never work out in the long run, I don't think. And especially when you're messing with the fabric of society in Argentina, if these you're taking over community assets that provide so much for the local community, whether or not there's some darker, you know, the Barra Bravas, whether there's some darker associations to it or not, I think you're messing with a very sacred thing to Argentinian culture that I think you don't mess with that, and it all works out in the end.
But same question to you, I suppose, was particularly with the Urban to Argentina there. You know, if, I sort of hypothesise, you know, let's say Microsoft decide to put £200 million into Boca Juniors, and Boca win the league three times in the bounce, win the Libertadores, win the Intercontinental Cups and whatever, the boat race and everything. Will Boca fans really care that it's Bill Gates owning the company? No, not disrespect to Bill, I'll just pick the name out of somewhere.
You know, you have the fickleness of fans here. It's everything. If you're winning, it's great. As soon as you're not, then things become a big problem. And suddenly you start questioning everything. You know, I'm slightly stereotyping here, but given the kind of the speed of managerial turnarounds in South America, generally, and particularly places like Brazil and Argentina, fans are very fickle. Managers do not last. If there is a problem, it becomes a really big problem very quickly. So, and I think that fans there are, I don't think they are a social movement per se. You know, if we're looking at the kind of movements we've seen in Britain, for example, or across the world against, you know, against modern football and, you know, against ticket prices and 20s plenty, I don't think we see that type of social movement. But what we have is a critical mass of volatility that has a certain other capabilities power-wise. So I think that you're messing with a lot of pride, you're messing with a lot of history, you're messing with a lot of tradition, and particularly if you're foreign as well, then that becomes a really big issue. So I think they do care, and I think they care even more if it doesn't go well, and then I think things get quite messy. So, do I think it will happen? Yes. The law has been passed. You know, I'm sure that, well, it's going to be very exciting. Tapia is a feisty character, so is Millet. So, you know, there's going to be a war of words and no one's going to mince what they say. But, you know, I think that we're going to have legal challenges to it, first of all, I'm sure. But I think there are clubs that are waiting to take money. I think that's the nature of businessmen. I think that's the nature of the people who own football. I just wonder how you sell it to fans. But sooner or later, you know, people will be sold messages because people can be convinced. We just have to look at social media now. People are very convincible if emotions can be played, and football is about emotions, and emotions in football can be played. So I feel I'm quite pessimistic about it, but I think that it will be inevitable. I don't think it will be a big club. I think it will be a smaller one to start with. But then I also think that it's part of the extractivism and part of the, you know, it's just kind of formalizing a flow that already exists in lots of ways. Yeah, so I think that's kind of my answer. They do care, some won't, some can be convinced, you know, because it's not homogenous. Emotions are easily played.
Yeah, well, you've answered my third question there, which is, is it going to happen? So I'll come to the second question last, but come to you, Matthew. Do you think it's going to happen, given what Pete said?
Well, I mean, yeah, because like you said, money talks and laws get changed and legal action gets taken, and it's the inevitable creep of capitalism into what was. Yeah, I think it'll happen. It won't take. I think it'll happen, and even if one of the smaller clubs gets taken over, you know, they get sweet honey whispered in their ears and promise huge tomorrows and decades of success. It could go wrong, and I don't think that'll stop. There'll still be another one that comes along and invests again, and it sucks, and I don't see it stopping. I don't see it being stalled. Really, it's this the inevitable creep of the future. Very depressing, and I really hope that, you know, the social fabric of Argentinian football manages to survive it. Really, might be down to some of the bigger clubs like Boca and River and Racing and all those clubs to survive it, really, and to keep what they've got going. It's all very depressing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a little bit, yeah. Okay, but I'm going to come to you with the last question first then, Matthew. Could the change in ownership, assuming, you know, you both think it's going to happen, and depending on whether it's a big club or a small club, but let's assume it's probably one of the big clubs, could it have a positive effect on the Argentine national team?
I mean, does it need it? I mean, they're pretty successful as it is. They are a big country that has a rich history of developing players, and they've not had this before, and there's been no real problems. I think more the problems, in inverted commas, comes with the status of the league and not being able to convince these players to stay and to resist the riches of European football and possibly now Middle Eastern football. I guess it could, but it's also something that you're trying to fix a problem that doesn't really exist, I think. I mean, I could be wrong. Pete could blow me out of the water now and tell me I'm wrong, but I just don't think that problem is there to fix.
That's interesting. I mean, I guess what was in my sort of mind is that, you know, when Argentina play friendlies, because so many of their players are based in Europe, almost all the players are based in Europe, they'll travel to Europe to play. I mean, would it be beneficial to have half a dozen, seven, eight, ten of the top-ranked Argentinian players playing back in Argentina with that strength? And I know what you're saying about, you know, they've won the World Cup, they've won the South American Championship. So, yeah, I mean, but, you know, you always want to improve. And Messi's going to be gone soon.
Yeah. I think the thing we haven't, maybe I think we've been talking for an hour now, I forget what you mentioned earlier, but the reasons for Milei to bring this sort of stuff in is probably absolutely nothing to do with football. It's all to energize. I know because he's a bit of a eccentric character, isn't he? He said some stuff and he has some very very confusing views that seem to contradict each other. And as he got into power on the back of economic promises, right? He was going to fix the Argentinian economy.
Do you want the statement about it? I've got the quote that justifies it. So it basically says, in order to correct the terminal crisis facing the Argentine economy and mitigate the serious risk of further and much graver deterioration of the social and economic situation, it is necessary to rebuild the weakened capacity of economic operators and civil society organizations to carry out production and exchange of goods and services in the market. One of the most effective ways to achieve this reconstruction is the immediate removal of state barriers and restrictions that hinder the normal development of businesses while also promoting greater integration of our country in the global trade.
Oh, man, see, it's not romantic. There's nothing romantic about it. It's just, he's all it is to energise the economy and to try and bring more money in. Yeah. And
you have to imagine him holding a chainsaw.
Alice said the chainsaw, didn't he?
I saw the pictures, yeah.
I can't imagine Keir Starmer standing there with the chainsaw.
And it is worth saying that, you know, Argentina's economy is screwed. You know, the inflation is massive. It's this is one of the reasons why he's there, because there is a really serious economic problem in Argentina. You know, whether he's
not the answer.
No, I mean, whether he's the answer or not, you know, the proof of the pudding will be there. I mean, I think we all have our opinions about this.
Indeed.
You know, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I've got students who've been in Argentina on their year abroad. They've been telling me that every week they go to the supermarket, things are getting more and more expensive. You know, I wonder if that will start coming down.
So, yeah, I think this is like a sequel podcast to this, really, is because Milei is a populist. He's riding that wave of populism across the world, and a lot of that support seems to ride on the back of sports fans, whether it's Britain and football, Argentina football, America with their various sports, and it's something that warrants further discussion and further exploration, but the link between sports and populism is something that confuses me and sort of fascinates me in a grim way. And it's that, isn't it? It's sort of riding that wave of populism to power and promising the world, but using sport as a vehicle to do that.
It's worth noting that he invited the players to the Casa Rosada, the presidential palace. They didn't go.
Oh, really?
It's interesting. Yeah. I'm reading a book at the moment about populism in South America, and it's about Chavez, Morales, and Correa. And it's a similarity. They all ignore the structure of government and talk directly to the people. And it's amazing the similarity I've got now. I'm sort of on my hobby horse now a bit. How so much is happening in the UK as well with social media, Twitter, with people at GB News and Tice, Farage, Isabel Oakeshott, and all these sort of—I won't use the word I was going to use—but they're almost ignoring the structure. That doesn't matter now. But get the people on board, everything's fine. And as you say, you know, when the economy's in desperate stakes, people reach out to extremes. And yeah, Milei is a little bit of an example. It'd be interesting to see if he survives his full term. Anyway, we're off the subject a little bit there, but you can't be doing a little bit of politics when you're talking about South American football. So I just want to say massive thanks to Matthew for coming along and talking about and being sort of fairly reticent about multi-club. But, you know, you've got to say what you think sometimes, Matthew.
I feel like it didn't fully get across my opinion, so I'm happy to do it again.
Okay, good man. Now, you've said that, so you've got to come back next week. Can you come back next week, as they say in all the quiz shows? Pete, thanks again, as always, mate. It's not only entertaining, but also educational as well. Thanks so much, buddy.
No problem. Always happy to talk about these kind of things when it, you know, affect, I mean, it's one of those issues that is a local issue, but really does speak to a global process. So it's probably worth talking about, I think.
Okay, so that rounds out our conversation about Argentina and the potential changes in club ownership and multi-club ownership and how that might affect things. So thanks for listening. Catch us next time on the LOB podcast from These Football Times.
Many thanks for joining us today on the LOB, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.